President Barack Obama last month announced that juveniles will no longer be held in solitary confinement in federal prisons. And there's wide bipartisan support to look anew at the criminal justice system, including revisiting mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines and conditions of confinement. Meanwhile, however, a practice known as civil commitment ensures that some sex offenders who committed their crimes as juveniles can be detained involuntarily and indefinitely. Reporters George Steptoe and Antoine Gaudet focused on a case in New Jersey in their article for the Marshall Project. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization focusing on the American criminal justice system. George, Antoine, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Hi, my pleasure.
Thanks for inviting us.
Your story takes us through the case of specifically John Sanchez in New Jersey. Tell us about his plight.
So John Sanchez is a kid from New Jersey who grew up in a low-income family in the 90s. When he was 12 and 13 years old, he committed a series of sex offenses. He landed in a juvenile facility. He was released and he was picked up again on his 18th birthday and sent to the special treatment unit.
What was the pretext for bringing him back to this treatment facility at age 18?
In New Jersey, the legal threshold that you have to meet is you have to be determined by state psychologists to be highly likely to reoffend sexually unless involuntarily detained for intensive therapy to essentially kind of cure you of your deviant sexual arousal.
To be clear, it wasn't because he violated some aspect of his parole.
No, absolutely not. No, he'd actually only been released for 2 days. He wasn't charged with any new crime. But he's still there now, and that was 5 years ago, and he's now 23.
So regarding the legal definition of a sexually violent predator, does that vary greatly from state to state, or is there general consensus?
So there is state-to-state variation regarding the exact language of the definition of a sexually violent predator. But generally, it remains pretty much the same, and it's a person who has been convicted or charged with a sexually violent offense and who suffers from a mental abnormality or from a personality disorder that state-hired psychiatrists deem make that person likely to reoffend, to engage again in acts of sexual violence, would he be released. But in some states, such as New Jersey, you don't need to be convicted of a sex offense. You can only have been charged with a sex offense.
Civil commitment means in part that it's open-ended when the individual is eligible for release.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's essentially indefinite. None of the people in the STU have got any real idea of when they would be released. Some people that we spoke to said that through this kind of legal loophole, certain states are actually handing out life sentences to juveniles under the auspices of civil commitment.
How prolific is the practice in New Jersey?
At the moment, there's around 500 people in the special treatment unit in Avenel, and about 10% of those are waiting for their initial commitment hearing, so i.e. to determine whether they're going to be staying or not. And since the program's inception in 1999, 579 people have ever been committed. Only around 15% of those have been discharged to the community after treatment. More than half have been there for 10 years or longer, and at least 41 have died while civilly committed in Avenel.
How prolific is this practice across the country?
20 states and the Federal Bureau of Prisons have sexually violent predator laws, and currently we compiled data and we found that 5,400 people are currently held in those states.
Is it your sense that that number is fairly static, or is it growing or diminishing?
It depends, really. Some states are kind of considered better than others. So Wisconsin, for instance, is considered, I'm talking here in terms of the release rates. Wisconsin, for instance, is considered quite good. It's released more than 100 since the program began. Minnesota, on the other hand, which was the application of the civil the application of the sexually violent predator laws in Minnesota was recently ruled unconstitutional, and that may be in part because zero have ever been unconditionally released from that program.
But however, if you look nationally, it seems like the number of people civilly committed, including both juvenile sex offender and adults, has been constantly growing since the program's inception at the turn of the century.
Is this practice of civil commitment isolated only to sexually violent predators who've been convicted of such, or is it for other sorts of violent crime, be it assault, burglary, murder?
So the sexually violent predator laws were pre-existed by psychiatric civil commitment laws, and they were for people who, owing to a severe mental illness, were an immediate physical threat to themselves or others or property. And so the sexually violent predator laws kind of created a parallel system and essentially sort of expanded the legal definition to include a mental abnormality or personality disorders that may cause someone to reoffend sexually.
But was John Sanchez found to have those emotional slash mental deficiencies when he was taken from his home 2 days after turning 18?
So, so John Sanchez was apprehended by parole officers at his home in West New York on the morning of his 18th birthday. He was then taken to the special treatment unit in Avenel, where he was held for 9 months before he had his first commitment hearing. So to be clear, for those 9 months, there's no possibility of bail, and he wasn't charged with any new crime.
And was that nine-month period arbitrary? Could it have been 9 days, 9 weeks, or 9 years?
In New Jersey, the statutes guarantee a 20-day hearing, so i.e. you're guaranteed a civil commitment hearing within the first 20 days of you arriving at the special treatment unit. Nearly everyone always waives that right, in order to prepare properly for their civil commitment hearing.
And then it can take years in some cases before the civil commitment hearing where one is civilly committed.
And people might want to, people can spend that time exhausting other appeals or other legal remedies available to them. And just to be clear, I mean, the consequences of these hearings are, you know, pretty substantial, certainly in New Jersey. It can result in indefinite incarceration, so it comes as very little surprise, really, that residents would want to spend some time preparing a case.
What are some of the central arguments by advocates of the current system?
The idea is that, we're protecting the public from the very worst sex offenders. And depending on who you speak to, some advocates have absolute confidence in the ability of state psychiatrists to identify those who are highly likely to reoffend sexually. But a lot of the leading psychologists that we've spoken to, and certainly in the areas of juvenile delinquency, would say that it's actually extremely difficult to identify the handful of young sex offenders who would be likely to go on to reoffend. And not only that, they would say that no matter how heinous their past conduct, we as a society owe them a positive developmental experience. And it's that positive developmental experience, forging friendships, getting a job, completing your higher education, living with your family. It's exactly those kind of components that would actually would be more effective in diminishing someone's likelihood of sexually reoffending.
I believe one of the central tenets of the evolving juvenile justice system is that the adolescent brain and mind is different than the adult mind in terms of impulsivity and ability to recognize long-term consequences. And yet we're talking about this practice whereby decisions made by a teenager, that same kind of accounting extends ad infinitum potentially into adulthood. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, in 2013, the U.S. Justice Department sponsored a National Research Council report, which looked closely at the development of the adolescent mind and kind of helped upend certain misconceptions that have historically driven juvenile justice policies. And to be honest, their findings will come as no real surprise to anyone who's actually lived through adolescence. And they found that reckless or impulsive behavior in your teenage years generally tends to be a pretty lousy prediction of, say, for instance, career criminality in adulthood. So a lot of critics say, you know, it's actually really unjust to hold people long into adulthood despite the fact that they have no adult convictions on the basis of a crime that they might commit in the future.
I'm sure findings vary, but is there anything resembling a broad consensus regarding recidivism rates specifically for juvenile sexual offenders?
There is a near consensus to all the experts we spoke to came up with a recidivism rate of less than 5%, so it's one of the lowest recidivism rate across all crimes categories. The recidivism rate, according to the Bureau of Justice, the National Bureau of Justice, is 68% across 3 years, and it's less than 5% for juvenile sex offenders.
To the extent that the nation at large, and specifically lawmakers across the country, are revisiting the criminal justice system and sentencing guidelines, is this an aspect that has come to more attention prior to your article, for example?
There was two rulings in Missouri and Minnesota that questioned the constitutionality or ruled some aspects of these programs unconstitutional, so in 2015, but nothing regarding juveniles in particular that I'm aware of.
Was it specifically the aspects that related to an undefined period of sentencing? Of confinement?
In one of those cases, the judge said that it was needlessly punitive to keep people when they were no longer a danger to the public, no matter how heinous their past conduct.
George, Antoine, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
George Steptoe and Antoine Gaudet focused on this case in New Jersey in their article for The Marshall Project.